5829 or www.livingyogacenter.net. Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we will be talking about cotton. And it might seem, at first blush, to be a kind of a mundane thing to be talking about. And yet, when you start to think about it, and you appreciate all the uses to which cotton is put, you see that this is something that touches all of our lives in many ways every day. Certainly, the first thing that you'll think of is cotton as a textile material, you know, as clothing material, and probably we all wear a lot of things that are made out of cotton, but also in its different forms, as a fiber, as an oil, or as a seed, cotton is found in literally thousands of products, in foods, in cosmetics. It's even in the money, the paper money that we use every day. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about cotton and it's the many ways that it has helped shape the history, perhaps of the world, certainly of the United States. And our guest is Stephen Yaffa. He is author of a recently published book. Came out, I believe, last fall and will still be in bookstores if you're interested in reading. The title of his book is Big Cotton, and the subtitle, How a Humble Fiber Created Fortunes, Wrecked Civilizations, and Put America on the Map. It's published by Viking. Our guest, Stephen Yaffa, is a novelist, a playwright, a video producer. He's an award-winning screenwriter. He has written for a number of publications, including Playboy, Rolling Stone, Details, and also the San Francisco Chronicle. He makes his home in California. This is his first nonfiction book, and it is published by Viking. Again, it's out there in the bookstore if you want to read it. Questions are also welcome here on the program, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, Mr. Yaffa, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. And yourself?
Good, thank you.
Thanks for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Among, I guess, the things I would want to mention here just in terms of explaining your interest in the subject is you certainly come by your interest in cotton, honestly, at least in one sense. You grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts, and this was the place where the first, I hope I have this right, this is the first textile mill in the United States was located.
Yes, pretty close to that, actually. The first spinning mill was located in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, a few years previously, but the first real factory in the sense of both spinning and weaving cotton, that factory was in Massachusetts in Waltham, and then it moved to Lowell fairly quickly after that. So the first industrial empire created from cotton started in Lowell, Massachusetts, and in fact it was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And certainly the Lowells were a very important family, a big family in terms of early American industry, as well as being the Lowells of Lowell Observatory, and were very significantly involved with the history of Harvard University, and had a couple celebrated poets in the family. So the Lowell name is pretty important in American history.
That's right. In fact, the Boston aristocrats, the Lowells and Cabots and other families, were really totally responsible for raising the money and funding the cotton industry in the United States. And it made them extraordinarily wealthy along the way as well.
Well, how else do you account for your starting to dig into this topic and getting more interested in it to the point where you did a significant amount of research and we end up with this book?
That's a good question, David. By the way, the book came out about 2 weeks ago, not necessarily last fall.
Oh, my apologies. I guess somehow I thought it might have been a last fall release. So it's hot off the presses.
It's hot off the press. Well, here's basically what happened. I was writing a catalog that my wife was doing for upscale natural products, products that both combined a great deal of style with environmental responsibility. The catalog is Viva Terra, and when I was helping her by writing the copy for that, she was doing some organic cotton products. And I said to her, well, organic cotton, I mean, I understand about organic food because we happen to eat a lot of organic food, but who knows about organic cotton? why would there be organic cotton? And she said, well, Stephen, call up this woman in Texas whose name was Lorea Pepper, and she'll explain it to you. So I called up Lorea, and Lorea grows organic cotton out of Lubbock with about 30 other families. And so I started talking to her, and she said, well, Stephen, the problem with conventional cotton is that it's one of the dirtiest products on earth in terms of the amount of pesticides and herbicides it uses. And because I live in an area where cotton is grown, I have seen the effects of all of that on the workers in the fields. In fact, there are cotton widows all around me whose husbands have died in the fields prematurely because of the extraordinary amount of chemicals and pesticides in cotton. In fact, she said, you know, it's environmentally dangerous. It's not dangerous to wear a pair of jeans because it's been bleached out, but every pair of jeans basically contains 3/4 of a pound of chemicals in it, fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, and so forth. And I started to think about that, and I thought to myself, whoa, that's a story that not many people know. So I was in touch with my agent in New York, and I mentioned to her that there might be something in this, and she said, well, you know, nobody really wants to read a book about how bad cotton is for you. Why don't you do this? Why don't you write a social history of cotton and include all this information in it? And then that really started me on the path, and that plus the connection I had to actually growing up in this one city in America where, you know, which established in many ways the economy of the United States on the basis of cotton led me into doing the book.
Mm-hmm. There are apparently cotton was independently domesticated in two different areas of the world, in Asia and in the New World. There are some differences between those cottons. Does anyone really know, has it been pinned down to a particular place where cotton originally came from?
There are two places that it came from, and it's an interesting story because two cultures quite independently from one another, 10,000 miles apart, developed the same tools, essentially, to create fabric from the plant. One of them was in northern Peru, and the other was in the Indus Valley in what is now Pakistan. And by the way, there might have been a third at about the same time in what is now Ethiopia. But those are the three areas that cotton was first domesticated, and David, it was probably about 5,500 years ago. There's also some cotton that was found in a cave in Mexico from that time. So it's a little spotty, but definitely the Indus Valley and definitely Peru. And one thing about a cotton bowl, which is really the capsule that contains the lint, that I should point out, which is that it's very tough and leathery, as a result of which it tends to float across oceans fairly easily. And so the migration of cotton, as I explained in my book, would be sort of like trying to track it would be like looking at a child who taking a crayon and marking up a globe while it's spinning. It goes in all directions over millions of years until it lands in these different areas.
Mm. One thing I think is interesting and a significant difference between these kind of cottons has to do with the length of the fibers, and I think that probably that relates to a term that I'm sure a lot of people have heard and probably don't really understand, and that is staple length. I'm sure people have heard, you know, about something being long staple cotton, and that's supposed to be good, and yet I'm sure if you asked them, well, what does that mean, they'd say, well, I don't know. That is what we're talking about. The Asian cottons, I think, tend to be shorter fibers. Those from the New World tend to be longer. And I guess the one thing that I understand about this is longer is better. But you can explain why.
Yes, size definitely matters when it comes to cotton. There are two kinds of cotton in the world these days. One is a green-seeded upland cotton, which is the cotton that made the South wealthy. That's a sticky seed cotton, and it's considered to be medium staple. There's the longer staple black-seeded cotton, which is basically known as Pima cotton these days, which essentially is Egyptian cotton, a slight difference in variety. The difference basically is this, that when you wind up making yarn, you've got to pull the fibers apart and continue to thin them down. And the cotton fibers are spiraled if you look at them under a microscope, so they cling to one another. And you take a long length of cotton and continue to pull it, and then you twist it. Well, if you've got 2-inch staples, which is a very long fiber, as opposed to an inch, which would be sort of like a typical medium staple, an inch or an inch and a quarter, that difference of a half or 3/4 of an inch is crucial because Once you pull the fiber as thin as you can and twist it, you are creating strength by twisting these fibers together. And if you can pull it longer and then twist it, you can create a sturdier fiber that's also thinner at the same time, which is why you get high-end Egyptian cotton and Pima cotton that is very fine and yet has a lot of tensile strength at the same time. Whereas if you were to do the same thing with a medium-length cotton, which is what we all wind up wearing and using in sheets, the cotton actually performs quite well, but it doesn't have that extra dimension of fineness about it.
Mm. Something else that I think is interesting that I learned, and other people might not know, is that cotton comes in colors. Naturally, it comes in colors. And that now, again, if you go out and you ask people, well, what color is cotton? They'll give you a funny look and say, well, it's white, because we've all seen, maybe people have actually seen what cotton looks like in its natural state and probably think of cotton balls or something like that. And what's on the end of a Q-tip? It's white. But the fact is that there are a number of naturally occurring colored cottons.
Yes, actually cotton comes in about 36 different varieties, and for a long time in South America in particular, cotton was picked and grown and loomed in a variety of colors, pretty much the colors of the rainbow with few exceptions. The most predominant are various shades of brown, from mocha through darker brown, and there is, in fact, in Peru, there is a thriving community that continues to grow brown cotton and use it in various products. A guy named James Vreeland has spent a fair amount of time cultivating that plant, and a woman in the United States named Sally Fox was doing the same thing, trying to introduce brown cotton into the United States. And it's an interesting part of the fun of doing this book was that as you're discovering these things, having read my book, I was discovering that when I wrote it, because I, you know, like anybody else, I assumed that, well, there is cotton, and of course there's cotton because there's white cotton, and what else is there? In fact, cotton in its natural state is actually kind of a yellowish, has a kind of a yellowish hue to it, and it's really only when optical whiteners are applied to cotton that it turns white in the way that we are familiar with it.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Stephen Yaffa, he's authored a book that will tell you everything you ever wanted to know about cotton. It's titled Big Cotton, How a Humble Fiber Created Fortunes, Wrecked Civilizations, and Put America on the Map, and it's published by Viking. It is out now, and it's just out. It came out actually at the beginning of January and is in bookstores if you'd like to read it. And, of course, questions are certainly welcome. The telephone number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, someone who has a question to ask, so we will get right to them. And they're in Indiana on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. I'm certainly glad you got into this aspect about cotton, because it's certain, in some respect, I remember some of the Technicolor films I've seen and some of the black and whites. My God, the cotton fields are about as white as you could possibly get them, which makes me wonder if they've done some sort of thing to the films, or that slight yellowness in regards to a brown background makes it look like it's white when we're looking at it. I wonder about that. But what led the industry to do the whitening, so to speak? I remember as growing up, whiteness was purity. And, if you did something to your grandmother's white tablecloth, you might as well forget it the whole weekend, Thanks a lot.
All right. Is there some particular reason that accounts for the preference for white?
Just described it as well as it can be described, really, which is essentially that we equate whiteness with purity. And whiteness also had a second element to it, which was beneficial to the manufacturers, and that is when dyes were applied to it, and most cotton is dyed in one form or another. Obviously, the dyes stay relatively true to the color because the ground of the background is now as pure white as possible. But purity is really essential in all of this for the same reason, and actually using a lot of the same chemicals that teeth whiteners and other whiteners are used. It has to do with absorbing the blue rays and so forth. But aside from the technical aspects of it, it's just simply as the caller described. It's to make us equate something that we automatically take in as being pure and find very attractive for that reason. So the equation of whiteness and cotton, the cotton industry worked very hard to plant that concept in our minds.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, too, though, again, among the interesting stories in here, we're in the section where you're talking about the Indian cotton industry and how that helped touch off the Industrial Revolution, because people in Britain were very interested in Indian cottons, that it's actually not an easy thing to get cotton to take dye. You have to do a lot of things to it to really get it to take up the color.
That's right, David. One of the reasons is that cotton is cellulose, which essentially is any tree you look at, and cotton are related, distantly related, but they have essentially a lot of chemistry in common. And as a result of being cellulose, it does not necessarily absorb dyes, with the exception of indigo, which is a major exception. Otherwise, it tends to lake or create a resistance to the dye that's being applied. And so in order to get the cellulose to absorb the dyes, they had to treat the dyes, and they called it animalizing them, which is to add animal proteins to the cellulose. In India, this was figured out about 7 or 8 centuries ago, a long, long time before the West figured anything out even comparable to that. And there were specialists who dyed, and they were all vegetable dyes at the time. And the trick was essentially not to simply apply the dye, but to maintain a dye that remained fixed so that when it was washed, the dye color didn't fade. And that seems to us natural, but it was not a natural occurrence for centuries.
All right. Well, let's go on, and we'll talk with someone else. I have a caller in, someone calling from a mobile phone, car phone, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Hello. How are you?
Good.
I would like to know if you would speak just a little bit to the natural evolution of cotton. I know that with corn, for instance, it started out as a grass that was crossbred and inbred until it became the plant that produces the ears that we know today. I can only assume that something similar happened with cotton, that the fibers of cotton served some purpose in nature before humans got a hold of it and started modifying it. I just wanted to know if you knew anything about that, and I'll just go ahead and hang up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
A great question, and the answer is that there's not a lot of historical data on how cotton was first domesticated. There are 36 kinds of cotton out there in the universe, but only two or three of them really lend themselves to the kind of domestic use. One was in Asia. They all have, of course, Latin names, which I won't go into, but they all had the same trait. And so once they were domesticated, there was not a lot of modification going on from that point on. They essentially have to produce lint, which is obviously the fiber. And by the way, every little pod, which is about the shape of a walnut, called a cotton boll, obviously, contains about 500,000 fibers, all connected to seeds one way or another. That essentially was the profile, and has been the profile for thousands of years.
All right. Next, we'll go to another caller, and this is someone listening in Champaign. It's line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You talked about fortunes being made with cotton, and one of the ones that I know a little bit about but like to know more about, if possible, is Potter Palmer, who was kind of famous here in Illinois in the development of Chicago and real estate and development and so forth, and the Palmer House Hotel, and he financed a lot of the buildings that became like Marshall Field stores and so forth. And I understand he made his first fortune in kind of cornering cotton in the North right before the Civil War, because he kind of predicted that the northern states would be cut off from cotton during a conflict. And what are the more explicit details about that?
Well, I can honestly tell you, I know absolutely nothing about Potter Palmer's connection to cotton.
So. Cotton, okay. Well, who are some of the other people then that made fortunes with it?
I can definitely tell you about the process that went on, but not necessarily his direct involvement. basically, the cotton trading in this country took place in New York. And as the conflict between the North and the South escalated, as a lot of people may or may not know, a lot of the Southern plantations were financed. In fact, almost all of the money that went into financing the Southern cotton came from New York financiers. Some of it came from Southern banks, but a lot of it developed there. And so the North had a vested interest in maintaining the cotton plantations in the South, and a lot of that cotton went into New England's mills, and the rest of it, about two-thirds of it, went to England's mills. And so a lot of the money that was made had to do with trying to make sure that the conflict, which escalated between the North and the South, did not affect the trade. The trade was essentially conducted between the lords of the loom, who were obviously the manufacturing tycoons in the North, and the lords of the lash, as they were called, who were the plantation owners. Although I don't know about Palmer's connection to that specifically, I know that in many ways, stocks or inventory were built up as much as possible as the situation worsened, so that when the war came, there were men who profited greatly from having a huge inventory to ride them through. Although I have to say, and I'm not sure this, of course, this is true of Palmer, most of the people who had done that expected the Civil War to last anywhere from 3 to 6 months. That was a very, very common assumption at the time. And the fact that it lasted for as long as it did wiped out lots of fortunes because no one really had anticipated the length of the war.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. And again, other people who are listening are welcome to call with questions. We are almost at the midpoint of this hour. And again, our guest is Stephen Yaffa. He is a novelist, a playwright, has been a video producer, an award-winning screenwriter, has written for magazines, and has authored this book. It's titled Big Cotton, How a Humble Fiber Created Fortunes, Wrecked Civilizations, and Put America on the Map. It's his first nonfiction book. It's published by Viking, just out. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Maybe take a step back, and we could talk some more about cotton in America, but for a moment, maybe we talk a little bit about England, about cotton, and about the Industrial Revolution, because all those things go together. And then very quickly, it makes the jump from England across the Atlantic to the United States. As we talked about a little earlier, there was a point when some of the most, at least as far as Europeans were concerned, the desirable cotton was coming from India because they were very highly skilled at producing it, at weaving, and at dyeing it. And there was a great, in the middle 1600s, I guess, there was enormous demand for Indian cotton in Europe, in France, and then also in England. And that led some people in England to think, well, I think we should be able to make this ourselves. Why buy this from India when we can make our own? And this comes to the story of a man named Richard Arkwright, who is a very important figure, perhaps one of the first important figures in the Industrial Revolution. Tell us about him.
Sure. I have to say, one of the fascinating parts of the whole process of researching cotton to me, David, was the extraordinary gallery of rogues and crooks and larcenists and incredibly inventive, ingenious people who are often the same person, by the way, who got involved in the history. And Arkwright represents all of those traits. He was a guy in the late 18th century, about 1770, 1780, in Lancashire, which essentially was a bunch of hills and sheep and foggy weather and all the rest of it up there in the Midlands of England, who was the son of a barber. And he made wigs, and making wigs, he had to string the strands of hair together. So when the first inventions were being created, hand inventions like the spinning jenny by James Hargreaves in about 1760, he took special interest in that. And these were all ways of taking what essentially had been a manual operation for centuries, which is spinning, very laborious spinning and hand weaving cotton. Because of its short fibers, it takes much longer to do that than many other kinds of fiber, like wool or flax. So when Arkwright started to look at the way these things were being done, he also came across a couple of early mechanical versions of these hand-cranked machines. And he thought to himself, if I can take this from here and that from there, and basically lifted them without any compensation to the people who were the inventors, he put them together with a guy, and they invented what is called the water frame. And the water frame is essentially a way of taking the process of the spinning wheel and finding a way to elongate and twist thread and then wrap it around a spindle using hydraulic power from a nearby stream, and there were lots of streams and rivers in Cromford, where he came from, in Lancashire, using belt-driven machinery to do that. And I actually went back in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and looked at like a model of the first water frame, and you say to yourself, because really, lint is so extraordinarily fragile, and you know, you're using in technology that existed 300 years ago, it's extraordinary how they were able to take this extraordinarily delicate operation and find a way to mechanize it. And that really became the genesis of the factory system that really has controlled lives in England and the United States ever since. Because once they were able, Arkwright was able to mechanize that, he was ambitious enough to put together what is really the first factory in this way that we consider the term these days, by creating a building near a river and having all of the machinery built right at that spot, and then attracting workers from all around Midlands to actually move. It was the first time in history that people actually left home to go work somewhere else, far from home. And families picked up and moved to this little town and created a town of Cromford, which in many ways is the prototype of all of the factory towns that have blossomed really all over the Western Hemisphere ever since.
And apparently it's a museum now, so that if you go there, you can actually go and see, you can see it. It's still standing.
That's right. Actually, a couple of guys in the 70s, 1970s, Arkwright had long been forgotten in Western history and so forth. He was like a footnote. They found the factory that he had put together in the late 18th century. It was filled with toxic paint cans. They cleared it out, and now the Arkwright Society in Lancashire and in Cromford has become a museum. And in fact, in Lowell, Massachusetts, which really happened about 25, 30 years after that, the factories that had all long been abandoned in Lowell, Massachusetts, have come back to life as a national park that I'm sure some of your listeners have been to. And it's a really interesting experience to go through the factories. By then, of course, they had steam engines and other kinds of energy sources, but essentially it was the same process of taking a fiber and transforming it into fabric. And it's that conversion process that I found extraordinarily interesting, because it was so difficult. It really required the sharpest, most advanced kind of intelligence and ingenuity in people to be able to perform it.
Is the is what Arkwright did, essentially, did he just take the Jenny and introduce the idea of mechanically making it mechanical, powered not by humans on a large scale? And is essentially not much difference between the water frame and the Jenny?
No, there's not very much difference between the two. There are other advances that came about after he made that major advance, and one of them had to do with something called the mule. And the mule essentially is a way of not only stretching the fiber before you twist it, but also being able to pull it at the same time in a different direction, so that what you wind up with, to make it as simple and visual as possible, you're able to actually twist and lengthen at the same time. That's kind of a slight extension of what he was up to, and it makes the fiber, by the way, stronger and less coarse. And that was kind of an invention that came around about maybe 5 or 6 years after he invented the water frame. But all of these, really, as you're describing, are modifications of the spinning jenny, which was a way of doing what had been done on a single spindle, transforming that into a jenny that accomplished the same feat in about 10 to 12 spindles simultaneously. So it really multiplied the ability of one person to spin a fairly considerable amount of cotton. Mm.
I love the story about Hargreaves, how he came up with this idea, whether this is apocryphal or not, that as people will maybe know that forever, just about forever, the spindle on a spinning wheel has been horizontal. And the story is that one day his daughter, whose name was Jenny, knocked the spinning wheel over, suddenly making the spindle go up and down, be vertical. And he looked at that and thought, why not not only set up a process where the spindle is vertical, why not put a whole bunch of spindles together? And that's the story about how it is he came up with the idea and why it's called the Jenny.
There are some wonderful stories that are either apocryphal or not. They certainly fit in, with the mythology of this. Another has to do with Eli Whitney, who in 1793, of course, invented the cotton gin. And the cotton gin essentially separates the fiber, a very sticky seeded, green seeded cotton, from the seeds. Something that had been taken a slave an entire day to perform, to loosen 1 pound of lint. Excruciating work and brutal work. His cotton gin separated 50 pounds in the same amount of time. And the apocryphal story, if it is apocryphal, was that when he was trying to figure out how to do this, he went into the backyard and saw a cat trying to corner a chicken. And at the last moment, the chicken took off, and the cat reached out with its paw and came back with a bunch of feathers. And so he thought to himself, you've got to pull the lint from the seeds, not pull the seeds from the lint. And that's a small difference, but a huge one to Whitney. Then he understood if you could reach into a drum with hooks and grab the lint and pull it and keep the seed from following by blocking the seed, you would essentially accomplish the same thing. And that's really the mechanism, the fundamental principle of the cotton gin.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the problem that plagued him and a lot of other of these men was that it was very difficult, let's say impossible, to protect your inventions. People just saw, one person would see what somebody else did and they'd say, well, I can do that, and would go back to his workshop and do the same thing. And maybe this gives us an opportunity to come here again to sort of where we started and to talk about Francis Cabot Lowell, who established the industry here in the United States. And apparently what he did was he was in Britain and he spent a lot of time looking at the textile industries there and looking at the way that they did things, and then brought what he learned back to the United States to set up his own industry.
He did it, and he did it really by a wonderful act of thievery. And the thievery essentially was that he was not allowed by his compatriots, actually, his friends who were the tycoons of the British textile industry, to take any written designs back with him because they were concerned about piracy, rightfully so. But they also wouldn't license him any of the mechanisms. But he happened to have a photographic memory. And he actually sat there day after day and memorized the working of the power loom, which is the second piece of component, along with a water frame. Extraordinarily complicated piece of machinery. He actually came back to the United States and recreated that from memory with an industrial designer, what would be an industrial designer today. And that's how the power loom and the water frame were combined into the same operation for the first time in history. And Lowell, Massachusetts, became the mecca of the free world, really, in terms of the ability to create an industrial society that was also advanced, because the women of Lowell, who were coming off the farm for the first time ever, also were very much involved with self-improvement. So during the day, they worked 14 hours in this fairly stifling environment, doing pretty tedious work. But at night, they actually went out into the world and listened to Ralph Waldo Emerson and all the people of the time who had something to say and were fairly well known for their cultural advancement. And the women put together a magazine called The Lowell Offering, which became an extraordinarily famous vehicle for working class expression at the time. Charles Dickens took it to Parliament in England. It became really an amazing piece of work because it really defied everybody's expectations of what factory workers were like. Here were women who were factory workers, and yet they were cultured. They were interested in learning, and they were able to express themselves. And so it was in the 1830s. There's really been nothing like it since in the United States.
We have someone else to talk with here, and that would be a couple of people caller in first in here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. Line number one. Hello.
Yes.
Yes.
Interesting. Could you say something about the finances? Like, did it require very much money to put in a crop each year? And what about futures? Records indicate in Japan, several hundred years ago, there were contracts that basically were futures for rice and silk. And hang up and listen. And what about the cotton, so-called cotton recession in the South about 1835 or 40?
All right. Yes. Well, go ahead.
That has always been part of the cotton story. Remember, cotton is a crop, and as your call is suggesting, there was a panic in 1839, and the economy of cotton has either precipitated the economy of the rest of the country, or it's mimicked it in many ways, because the ability to predict what the harvest is going to be and the quantity of cotton is going to be is really as chancy as whether it's going to rain or snow or tomorrow or on all the other elements, especially that have to do with the welfare of a crop, especially in days when there was no ability to create sophisticated irrigation systems. So futures in New York, men in the trading of cotton have made and lost fortunes overnight, and especially in the years leading up to the Civil War, there were wonderful stories, harrowing stories at the same time, of someone who was trying to corner a market, and suddenly there was a surplus of cotton as opposed to a dearth of cotton, and supply and demand worked against them. So yes, in the way that almost every crop has had futures in Japan and other countries, cotton is particularly susceptible to that. In fact, today, in 2005, we're looking at a crop from last year, which is one of the great bumper crops of the last decade, and that has plummeted cotton prices around the world as a result of the extraordinary abundance of cotton, and it's put a lot of people into a pickle who were expecting, of course, to have the demand for cotton greater than the supply. So it continues to this day.
How much American cotton is exported, and how does it fit in with the other things that make up American agriculture?
It to answer your question, about 3 million tons of cotton was exported last year or in 2003. That is about 45% of all the cotton that's exported in the world is exported from the United States. The next in rank would be West Africa, which is about 1 million. West Africa consists of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Benin. In terms of how that compares to other crops, I'm not really sure about that. I think probably soy would be pretty close to the second, or possibly corn. But I know in terms of cotton that the amount of cotton that we export directly affects the welfare of the growers in West Africa who are using primitive methods that are really have changed very little from before the Civil War in the United States. And I know that because I was recently on a delegation, an Oxfam delegation that went to Mali and looked at the effect of American cotton subsidies on the cotton farmers of Mali.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that a little bit more?
I very much would like to, actually, and I'd love to get reaction of any of your listeners who might be interested, too. One of the great debates in the United States in terms of agriculture right now is how much money we are giving to our cotton growers in the United States. There are about 25,000 of them, and we give them through a Farm Act in 2002 about $3.2 billion a year. 80% of that money goes to the top 10% of the cotton growers. There are cotton growers like the Boswells of California who in 1 year made something like $20 million. So there's a tremendous disparity here, and the reason that I think it matters, and the reason that Oxfam in particular and other nonprofit organizations are interested, is that a lot of the cotton subsidies that people consider to be really too high. Not that we are looking up for ways necessarily to eliminate them, but simply to bring them more into line with reality. These cotton subsidies often impoverish countries that are already poor, particularly in West Africa, and perhaps to some degree undermine our ability to counter some of the elements that lead to fomenting anger, which leads to terrorism in these countries.
Hmm. Well, we are in our last 15 minutes or so, and I have a couple of callers, and we'll get right to them. And I would like to again introduce our guest. We're speaking with Stephen Yaffa. He is a novelist, a playwright, video producer, award-winning screenwriter. He is also the author of a new book, which is his first nonfiction book, that explores all cotton and the way, particularly the role that it has played in the developing of the American economy and in the history of this country, but certainly goes beyond that. The title of the book is Big Cotton: How a Humble Fiber Created Fortunes, Wrecked Civilizations, and Put America on the Map. It's published by Viking. It's just out now, been out since the beginning of the month, and it is in the bookstore if you want to read it, and questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here. Next, we'll talk with someone in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. I found your story about Robert Lowell ironic because I think the British were charged with pirating the cotton industry from Calcutta, India, and effectively causing the terrible poverty that has gone on for centuries there. Did you see any, did your research support that?
A very good question. What happened in the 18th century in India was that England took a look at the incredible amount of cotton that was coming out of India, both being grown and manufactured in India, and decided that this was a terrific idea if they could figure out a way to develop their own industry with India. And the simplest way to do that, essentially, was to colonize India. And it wasn't the only reason that England wound up essentially attacking India and subjugating it, but it had a lot to do with it because the industry in cotton in Calcutta was really very much of a hand industry. What they considered to be a factory were maybe three or four people who were operating in the same building. But England had much greater ambition for cotton. And since it could not be grown in England, they needed a place for it to be supplied. To make a long story short, when England basically came in and took over India, it prevented anybody in India from growing and manufacturing cotton. So all the cotton had to go from India to England, be manufactured, and then sold back to the people who had grown it as fabric.
I have a follow-up question, and this is the last question. My understanding was they not just stole the cotton, but also the techniques of putting the fabrics that calico was came from the word Calcutta, Madras. All of these incredible patterns were taken, and so I have a question about that. And also, since you looked at social history, did you look at how these different fabrics developed their own patterns, I should say, of cotton developed their own history? Calico, which was, I think, probably the primary fabric that was used on the American frontier, and how Madras has became a major pattern, in fact, of elite, and this country now is considered a preppy fabric. Did you look at any of that?
Yes, and some of that is in my book. I talk more about the dyeing techniques than I do about the social significance of some of these patterns in England, but there are some wonderful books, including Woven Cargoes, which I would highly recommend if you wanted to learn more about that. The Victoria and Albert Museum in England is a terrific source, Rosemary Krill in particular. What I talk about is how chintz, which is essentially colored and often hand-painted fabric from the 17th century, became such a huge fashion statement in England that it really was the door that opened up cotton from the east to the west, because up until around 1700, as you might know, nobody in Europe, particularly in the northern countries, was interested in cotton at all. Flax was the fabric, and it was mixed with wool and something called linsey woolsey and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But the social significance, which you're asking me about very specifically and how it connected to the Hindu religion in India, is a fascinating subject and one that I touch upon a little bit in my book.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you for the call, and we will continue. And the next person up would be Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Yes, the caller from Chicago took some of the question that I had already, so I won't go into that. I would like to add a comment, and that is, in the middle of the 19th century, somewhere, I don't remember the name, the year exactly, but a law was passed in India that prevented any goods, agricultural goods especially, to be exported on any other ship than British ship, and thereby not only destroyed the cotton industry, but some other industries as well. And this is one of the reasons why probably Mahatma Gandhi took the spinning wheel as a symbolic instrument to agitate against the British Empire. And the second comment I have in that connection is regarding the stealing of technology, because today we are talking a lot about intellectual property rights, and most of them are now going against the interests of the developing countries to the extent that medications that were used thousands of years are now being attempted to be patented in the Western countries. The situation that came to discussion several years ago when John Kenneth Galbraith was visiting this campus here, and in a discussion he said that his recommendation to countries like India would be to refuse to pay any debts that India owed to Britain because of the kind of theft that Britain had done in India, and it would be totally morally okay. I wonder if any of those aspects are discussed in your book, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for the caller's question. The relationship of Mahatma Gandhi to cotton is something that I go into in some depth in my book. And as the caller suggested, Britain went to war with India largely because of the commodity. In fact, one of the interesting parts of reading, of doing the research for my book, is that I concluded that very few wars have ever been fought without some kind of a commodity way down at the bottom, if not more obviously as a part of the whole process. Oil in Iraq might be a very good contemporary example of that, although some of your listeners might dispute that. I found it to be interesting. Also, in terms of India, the subjugation of the Indian populace to the commercial requirements of Britain were so egregious that when Gandhi came into power, and he did it really by trying to speak for the Indian people who had been subjugated now for maybe 200 years, he looked at homespun cotton as a way to establish some sense of identity again. And so the theft, really, of an entire industry and an entire crop by England was still very much a motivating factor for him many, many years after it happened. And he went around to the villages and insisted that people start to build their own spinning wheels, as he did. And there are many shots of him with his home spinning wheel that he got up and used every morning. And so that Shukra, which is what it was called, became the symbol of Indian independence. And it's a really interesting story that I hopefully do justice to in my book.
Hmm. And it's on the flag of India to this day.
And it's on the flag of India. Very good point, David.
Indeed. Let's go to another caller, and that would be someone in Champaign in line two. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned earlier the subsidies in the U.S., the $3.2 billion. What is keeping that alive? Obviously, politics, but is there any justification other than politics for those subsidies? Certainly, cotton is not a strategic product to the United States. And you mentioned that $3.2 billion and 90% goes to 10% of the farmers. So where are the What's the thought process behind that? If you could, because it's certainly having a horrible effect on Western Africa right now.
It certainly is, and other places in the world too. And that's a discussion that could take a couple of hours, but to give it to you in a few minutes, essentially it's the power of the National Cotton Council and the political clout of the southern states, who still have a lot of seniority in crucial committees in Congress. The argument from American cotton growers would be that it also now affects the security of the United States, because in the event that we wind up being at war or being in an adversarial position, we need to have our own crops, and we need to be continuing to supply the world with cotton that we grow. But the truth of the matter is, without subsidies, there would really be no business reason for growing cotton in America. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't. I'm just saying, from a business point of view, it really doesn't make sense anymore, because the cost of producing cotton in America vastly exceeds what we can get for it on the international market. And the subsidies are there because the political clout of cotton and its historical connection to the United States has to be really reckoned into this. It's intangible, but it's very powerful, because from many regions of this country, the South in particular, cotton has a tremendous emotional power. So you put those all together, and you get really the situation that now exists, which I think really in many ways is going to jeopardize some of our relationship with countries that we really want to have a firm relationship with in the rest of the world.
We're going to have to stop with much more that we could discuss. If you're interested, again, look at the book. It's titled Big Cotton, published by Viking, by our guest Stephen Yaffa. His last name spelled Y-A-F-A. Mr. Yaffa, thanks very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome. I do have a website, which is stephenyaffa.com, and I mention it because more of the situation in Mali and other things that we got into a bit, the reader can find out, or the listener, excuse me, can find out more about if they visit the website. And thank you very much for having me, David.
Thank you. Programming today made possible by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe, downtown Urbana, for over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths. Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work dress, sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services at a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. The program also made possible with support from the Art Mart in Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support Public Radio in East Central Illinois. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about welfare with a reporter from the New York Times, Jason DeParle. He tracked one family's struggle to make ends meet without welfare. He tells their stories in the book American Dream, 3 women, 10 kids, and a nation's drive to end welfare. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. March wheat, 296¾, up 1½. May, 304¼, up 1½. March corn, 198¾, up 1. May, 206¼, up 1. July corn, 213½, up 1½. December corn, 230, that up 1. March beans, 525¼, up 5¼. May, 523, up 2¾.